Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Friday, July 25th. I'm Sigurd Bjørn, reporting for Kmart. In tonight's news, overnight rainfall slows down the Orleans complex fire. PG&E submits a plan to surrender the Potter Valley dams. Humboldt County inches closer to compliance with the Americans with Disabilities Act. Stay tuned, those stories and more coming up. We'll start with an update on the Orleans complex fire in Siskiyou County, where overnight rainfall helped slow down the fire activity, and crews were able to continue strengthening containment lines. Jordan Pangilinan reports.
Operations Section Chief Trevor Johnson with California Interagency Incident Management Team, Team 4, provided an update on the Orleans Complex in a news release from the Klamath National Forest Facebook page, outlining the current status of both fires, today's activities, and plans moving forward. The Orleans Complex is currently standing at 19,455 acres with a 10% containment, and current personnel on scene is at 2,063.
Last night, Team 4 took command of the fire officially under Incident Commander Rocky Opplinger. And so we managed the fire overnight, had a very successful night shift across the fire. Off our map is the Red Fire, which is currently under our control. We have resources in there, but it's about 100 acres. We've been mopping up, patrolling that, and we're feeling really confident about the Red Fire, if you're familiar. I'll move down to the northern edge of our fire. This is out near Butler Flat. Crews are still in here engaged. Things are looking good. This is the Forks of the Salmon Road system. This road in country is very unforgiving. We're getting a lot of rocks rolling out on the road, so our firefighters are working diligently to secure all these lines, working south towards Forks of the Salmon, prevent rocks from rolling in the road, and preventing some spot fires from getting across the line. We're feeling very confident in that area with our containment lines. As we continue south towards Nordheimer Campground and Quail Flat, just a little bit more to do, but our crews have been way out here, our hotshot crews and other resources, securing this line that comes out of Quail Flat to the east up towards Yellow Jacket Ridge. That line is in place, and they're just finishing up the last pieces on it, and then they'll go to work on mopping up and securing that line even more. Down the map in Murderer's Gulch, this line is in place secure. We mopped that up 50 feet yesterday, and crews today will look to secure that even further. Continuing on along Sawyer's Bar Road, things are looking good along the road system, but again, we're being diligent. We're not getting complacent out there and making sure that our resources are engaged and keeping the fire within its current footprint. As we work south down towards Cecilville Road, this was our primary area of concern yesterday and last night. This ground in here is super inaccessible. The risk to responders is high. And as you can see, there's a piece of line, intersection of line here where the fire's not all the way down to the road. So what we're doing with that and what we've done the past couple days, especially during the nighttime, is we use our drones or our unmanned aerial systems to strategically fire this line using minimal fire behavior to bring the fire down to our lines. Yesterday, you heard we had a couple spot fires across the road here near Missouri Draft, if you're looking at the map. Our firefighters were out there. They were prepared for that. We're prepared for the same thing today, but we'll pounce on those quick and make sure that we extinguish them to the full extent. As we continue along the southern edge of our fire, crews again here, securing our lines, working to the west again. Everything's looking good. As we continue further to the west, our crews will be out here today, again, using firing as necessary, under strategic direction from our operations chiefs to bring fire to our containment lines and secure anything we need to. As we continue here to the west further, we're getting helped out a lot. Down here below us, highlighted in a darker color, is the red salmon scar of 2020. And that's helping us out as there's less vegetation in those areas for the fire to carry. We'll continue along the west side of our fire. Everything's looking good all the way around our western edge into Butler Creek. Crews have been out there securing our lines, monitoring, and we're feeling very confident about our lines. But again, we're remaining diligent with everything we've got going out there. Last area I'd like to point your attention to is out here to the east in our contingency piece. We got a lot of structures and a lot of cultural values out here that we want to be sure that you know that we're protecting. We're going out to all these road systems. Crews are currently cutting along the road systems to open up access and ingress. They're actively prepping structures, wrapping them, using sprinkler systems, and various other tools we have at our disposal to secure all those structures. Even further east, there's some contingency lines going in place over there, but everything's looking good. One last thing I forgot to mention, in Forks of the Salmon, we will have resources again in there all day today and tonight. We're feeling really good about our progress in there, but again, we want to make sure we're not missing anything, so crews will be out there validating our lines and everything's being secure. That's kind of the majority of our operational update, but just want to ensure everybody out there that Team 4 is committed to managing every aspect of this incident. So we're fiscally being responsible with our resources. We're providing for the safety and logistical support of our people. Our PIOs and our liaisons are doing their absolute best to message the community and all of you with that information. So a lot of stuff going on out here, a lot of planning to do in the future. We're not out of the woods, but again, we're doing things the right way, and we're confident in what we're doing. I'll be back on here again tonight for an evening operational update. Thanks again, and have a good day.
A red flag warning is in effect for Friday in anticipation of another round of thunderstorms for the fire area, gusty outflow winds in excess of 40 miles an hour, brief heavy rainfall, cloud-to-ground lightning, and small hail are possible over the fire area. There are evacuation orders and warnings in the immediate vicinity of the fire. For current evacuation status, visit the Siskiyou County Sheriff's Facebook and the Siskiyou County Office of Emergency Services Facebook. Additional evacuation information and a map can be found at protectgenesis.com. That's protect.genasys.com. An official forest closure around the Orleans complex went into effect on July 16th. Hikers are not permitted and will be asked to leave the area. Forest fire restrictions are still currently in effect. Visit KMUD for more fire resources under the Fire Resources tab. For KMUD, I'm Jordan Pangelinan.
A virtual community meeting is scheduled to start at 7:30 p.m. and you can find a link to it on the Facebook page of the Siskiyou County Sheriff's Office. As we reported on Wednesday, Humboldt County entered the historic Potter Valley Project Pact, which will see PG&E decommission two Lake Pillsbury dams and transfer the water rights to the Round Valley Tribe. And today, PG&E has taken the next step in this process by submitting a surrender application and decommissioning plan to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. The removal of the two dams will, among other things, allow fish to access habitat in the Upper Eel River watershed. If you want to know more about the ins and outs of the new Potter Valley plan, you can seek out Daniel Mintz's report on the subject from Wednesday, July 23rd. Search for KMUD News and Potter Valley Project on your favorite podcast platform. Here is a little bit of local good news from last week, when Providence unveiled a new portable X-ray machine at the Redwood Memorial Hospital in Fortuna. The machine will, according to a press release, enhance the hospital's ability to provide immediate bedside diagnostic care, particularly benefiting emergency room patients, critical care units, and individuals with limited mobility. Here ends the quote from the press release. The purchase of the machine was made possible by contributions from local residents who attended a fundraising event specific to this cause. Now, this sounds like an all-round good thing, and if the much-maligned healthcare organization is looking for its next bit of local do-goodery, here is Susan Potter from our partners at the California News Service with a short piece on what Providence has been up to in Southern California.
If you've got an extra 5 minutes, you can save a life. Now you can learn cardiopulmonary resuscitation at no cost from a new mobile hands-only CPR kiosk. The new kiosk is in the lobby of St. John's Health Center in Santa Monica. The machine's touchscreen gives a brief overview of hands-only CPR. Then you get to practice right there on a mannequin. Cardiologist Rigved Talwalkar says it's an easy way for people to get more comfortable giving chest compressions in an emergency.
It's a lot like a video game, but of course a lot more important than a video game. It gives real-time feedback about the depth and rate of compressions, proper hand placement, which are all factors that influence the effectiveness of CPR.
The American Heart Association operates the St. John's mobile kiosk and a stationary model at LAX with support from the hospital. Santiago Canyon College in Orange County also has a mobile hands-only CPR kiosk, now through September, sponsored by Edwards Life Sciences. Orange County businessman Stephen Munitonis says he survived what's known as a widowmaker heart attack that led to cardiac arrest 9 years ago, thanks to his 17-year-old son, who gave him immediate CPR with instructions from a 911 operator.
You don't have to put your mouth to anybody's mouth. You just put your hand on their chest and pump. He saved me, and others can do the same anywhere. So it's absolutely a life-saving, heroic act that anybody can do.
Statistics show that 350,000 Americans suffer from cardiac arrest outside of a hospital each year, and about 90% die, in part because they don't receive CPR. About 70% of those cardiac arrests happen at home, so people often depend on family or friends to give CPR before an ambulance arrives. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Now, I'm no expert in anything really, but I do know a bit of CPR. And I think the idea of a mobile CPR teaching kiosk in Humboldt County is fantastic. And since the kiosk is mobile, it doesn't have to be nailed down to one location. And it doesn't have to be exclusively at the Providence facility either. Maybe it could travel between local health organizations in the county, so people could learn in a no-fuss way how to save a person's life. The kiosk could be at Soham Health 1 month, at Providence in Fortuna the next, then United Healthcare in Arcata the month after that, and so on. It could even travel to our neighbors in Del Norte and Trinity too, before ending back up in Soham again. Something for the good people who raised the funds for the X-ray machine at Providence to ponder. And if you want to learn CPR the old-fashioned way, there are courses available in the Humboldt Bay region. They cost about $50 to $65, and you can check out the schedule at kissercpr.com. That's Kisser, spelled like a kisser, but only with one S. So it could be Kaiser. Who knows? I don't. But there it is. We are going to hear more good news from our partners at the California News Service later. But first, here is Daniel Mintz with a report on how Humboldt County's 9-year quest to comply with the Americans with Disabilities Act is going.
Almost 9 years after entering a court-enforced Americans with Disabilities Act work plan with the U.S. Department of Justice, Humboldt County has completed 93% of the required projects and will continue to remove access barriers. The status of the county's ADA compliance was updated at the July 22nd Board of Supervisors meeting. The county entered into a consent decree on ADA improvements in 2016, and 93% of the 1,535 projects identified in it have been completed. The federal consent decree expired in 2020 as the Department of Justice decided not to take further action. But the county's ADA work includes many projects not included in the consent decree. In 2021, the board adopted a 20-year ADA compliance plan on buildings owned and leased by the county. Some of the facilities with ADA improvements may not be occupied by the county in the future, and there's uncertainty about federal policy, as discussed in this exchange between Supervisor Mike Wilson and Assistant County Administrative Officer Karen Clower.
We may not be in those buildings forever, right? And we may be looking for new places to go, but they didn't seem to really be too concerned about the movement of moving beyond those spaces, which has had impacts in our ability to finance moving to new places. So in some ways, you know, this requires us to spend money on buildings that we don't own, some of which are beyond their lifespan technically. And so we're spending a lot of money on places we may not be under this consent decree from the federal government. My question kind of leads to now we have a different administration. What's our relationship with the DOJ? Is there actually, with all the firings of the DOJ and everything that's been happening there, how is there still an ADA group there? And second tier off of that is with the sort of the rhetoric and sort of the issues around what they consider diversity, equity, and inclusion, has there been impacts in the ADA programs at the federal level based on those new policies?
To answer your first question, we have not been in contact with the DOJ, and quite honestly, we hope to not have to communicate with the DOJ over our ADA compliance.
The status of ADA law was further discussed in this exchange.
Some of the support networks are concerned about, and that would be like your Pacific ADA Center, your Northwestern ADA Center, that are funded through federal dollars. There is some concern that they may be losing a portion of their funding, but ADA has not gone away. It is a civil rights law. We are way behind the timeline established by the ADA to make our buildings compliant, and that's why we ended up in the consent decree.
I hear you. You know, the Voting Rights Act is also a civil rights law being reinterpreted by this administration in very dramatic waves. So just because something is a civil rights law at the federal level doesn't mean that we're not seeing significant policy changes around its interpretation.
I've not heard of significant changes around the ADA at this point.
I hear you.
ADA projects in the fiscal year that recently ended include the Arcata Branch Library, Ronerville Airport Terminal, Juvenile Hall, and the Ferndale Veterans Building. The status of the consent decree and the need for keeping up with ADA fixes was discussed in this exchange between Supervisor Rex Bone and Clower.
Didn't we get relieved from the consent decree because of the work? I mean, we still have to do it. But because of the work you had done, the time frame we did it, and the way we approached it with the CAO and especially you and Travis doing this, aren't we released from the consent decree? It's not. I mean, we still have it, but it's not a shadow hanging over us anymore. Would that be the right term? Or
Yes, we've been released from the terms of the consent decree. Yeah. Part of the negotiations for that was the continued progress in making improvements. So that's something that we strive for each year, is to continue to remove some of those barriers that had been identified in the consent decree if we're still in those facilities. So what we don't want to have happen is
get them back
to rise to the level of a complaint that reaches the Department of Justice and have them come back and reassess.
The total general fund cost of the county's ADA projects is $14.3 million, with $2.2 million in fiscal years 2025 and 2026. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
And here, as promised, are our partners at the California News Service, Ross Brown this time, sharing a feel-good story about an island fox.
A small fox that lives on the Channel Islands off the coast of Southern California is thriving after near extinction. The island fox, found nowhere else on Earth, was listed as endangered in 2004 when only about 30 remained. A multi-agency recovery effort that started in 1999 resulted in the fastest comeback of any terrestrial mammal under the Endangered Species Act. Photographer Chuck Graham has traveled to the islands to chronicle their recovery and share the story.
It wouldn't have happened with all the work of the biologists and everything. I mean, otherwise, if it wasn't successful, then, you know, it would have been a really big disappointment. But everything worked out.
Revered by the island's early indigenous people, the fox weighs just 4 pounds, smaller than the average house cat. A photo exhibit by Graham is currently showing at the Santa Barbara Maritime Museum. The population began plummeting in the 1960s after predatory golden eagles replaced bald eagles, who could no longer breed on the islands due to the effects of runoff from the pesticide DDT. Before the island fox could recover, golden eagles were relocated to the mainland and 61 bald eagles were reintroduced starting in 2002. With the predators gone, the fox survival rate increased to 90%, and the population rebounded to more than 2,000 in 2015. Graham says he wanted to document not just the island fox, but its environment and the urgency of preserving it.
I knew the foxes were an item, and I knew the bald eagles were, but it's one of those things where you just got to go to know. I mean, I've brought an awareness.
Scientists still debate how the foxes got to the island some 10,000 years ago. Some speculate they rafted there on storm debris when ocean levels were lower, or were more likely introduced by the Native American Chumash tribe, who considered them a sacred animal. For California News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
And now, for the last item on tonight's agenda, Ray Hamill's sports report. which includes news of local participants in a 500-team Native American Junior Nationals tournament in Arizona, and an update on how the Crabs are faring in their quest to secure a spot in next week's League Championship Series.
The Humboldt Crabs are hoping to secure a place in this year's Pacific Empire League Championship Series this weekend, as they look to bounce back from a disappointing showing last week. Hello and welcome to this week's K-Mud News Sports Report. I'm Ray Hamill with HumboldtSports.com. We'll have more on the Crabs and their championship ambitions in just a moment, as we take a look at all of the big local sports stories of the week, including why it's going to be a big weekend for one Humboldt County fighter, how a local youth basketball team put Humboldt County on the map at a recent national tournament, and something new planned for the Redwood Acres Raceway as motorsports return to the North Coast this weekend. But first up, the Humboldt Crabs are in the midst of an exciting race for the second and final spot in this year's Pacific Empire League Championship Series. A disappointing showing last weekend against the league-leading Healdsburg Prune Packers put a dent in the team's championship ambitions, but the Crabs remain in the chase as they get set for their final regular season league series of the summer. Last week, the Crabs welcomed the Prune Packers to the Arcata Ballpark, but dropped all three games of the series to fall into a tie for second in the standings with the Lincoln Potters. All three games were close. The Packers took game one 3-2, as the Crabs were unable to take advantage of their opportunities, stranding 12 runners on base, twice as many as the Packers. The hosts rallied from an early two-run deficit to tie the game, but Healdsburg had the final say, scoring what would be the winning run in the top of the eighth inning and holding on down the stretch. Saturday night's showdown was just as disappointing, as the Crabs saw a 3-2 lead disappear late in the game when the Prune Packers scored three unanswered runs to pull out a 5-3 victory. The Packers would rally again to overcome a late deficit in Sunday's series finale, scoring three runs on a pair of home runs in the top of the ninth inning on the way to winning 7-5. The three wins secured the top seed for the championship series for Healdsburg. The Crabs would respond with a pair of victories over the Berkovich Honors in a two-game non-league midweek series. They took the opener 9-1 on Tuesday before securing the sweep the following night with an exciting 8-7 walk-off win. Former Eureka High and College of the Redwoods player Parker Rogers scored the winning run on Wednesday on a wild pitch. With those two wins, the Crabs improved to 34-8 on the summer. Despite last weekend's sweep, the Crabs can still secure a spot in next week's League Championship Series, although they will need some help. As of Thursday night, they were one win back of the Potters in the league standings and will need them to lose at least one of their final three games, while also taking care of business in their series against the Rogues. Game one of the series at the Arcata Ballpark is set for Friday night at 7. If the Crabs do advance to the best of three championship series, they would receive the number 2 seed and open at home against Healdsburg on Tuesday night before travelling to Healdsburg for game 2 and a possible game 3. Elsewhere in local sports this week, Humboldt County bare-knuckle fighter Ryan Peterson is getting ready for a big weekend. After a breakthrough fight at the Bear River Casino Resort last year, the Hydesville resident has quickly established himself as an up-and-coming fighter in the world of bare-knuckle fighting. Peterson is closing in on a possible title fight with the Bare Knuckle Fighting Championship, and on Friday night, he will headline a BKFC fight night in Philadelphia, where a victory for the welterweight could see him get a title showdown. Peterson will take on Dustin Paig in the main event, which will be broadcast live all over the world on several platforms, including Amazon Prime, Fubo TV, and the BKFC app. The 40-year-old Peterson, who last fought in January, is 2-0 in BKFC fights, while Paig is 4-2. Peterson also recently became the first fighter to be inducted into the Bear River Fighters Hall of Fame. In local youth basketball, meanwhile, a group of Orleans players recently made the trip to Arizona to compete at the Native American Junior Nationals Tournament. The event attracted more than 500 Native American teams from all across the nation, and the Orleans boys and girls 7th and 8th grade teams both did a good job representing the county. The Orleans boys, who played 8 games in just 3 days, rallied from a shaky start to tournament play. After losing all 3 of their pool games, the young Orleans boys won 3 straight games to advance to the semifinals in their bracket, where they fell to a team from Washington that would go on to clinch the tournament championship. The Orleans boys responded to that loss with a win over a team from Arizona in the third place game. The Orleans girls also participated, going 2-1 in pool play before losing their playoff opener. And rounding out another busy week for local sports, motorsports returned to the Redwood Acres Raceway this weekend with a new twist. The local raceway will debut a new division on Saturday night with the debut of the Dirt 4 Bangers. The Dirt 4 Bangers will race on the infield dirt track, and raceway officials are expecting around 10 cars for the division this weekend. The 2025 Redwood Acres season is at the halfway point, and a packed night of action on Saturday will also include the Mid-City Motor World Late Models, the Upstate Bomber Series, Legends, Junior Legends, Mini Stocks, and Vintage Midgets. And that's this week's KMUD News Sports Report. Until next time, I'm Ray Hamill with HumboldtSports.com.
That's it for our news today. Thanks to our engineer, Michael McCuskill, and thanks to our reporters, Jordan Pangilinan, Daniel Mintz, Susan Potter, Ross Brown, and Ray Hamill. My name is Sigurd Bjorn. Thank you for listening.
KMUD News is online. You can find us on kmud.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commute. You can also follow us on social media. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org.
Redwood Community Radio is funded by Press Forward, a national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitters are located on unceded territory of our local tribes and honors the cultural, spiritual, and physical connection the tribes have to this region.